Welcome to the Edify Podcast, where our guests share practical wisdom on living our faith in public. I'm Mary Fiorito. Thank you for joining us today.
Our guest today is Rebecca Kiesling. In 2020, Rebecca's life changed dramatically when her two sons, Caleb and Kyler, died of fentanyl overdoses on the same day, along with another friend. And she's here today to share her story with us. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us. We're so grateful to you for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. And just to clarify, they didn't die of a fentanyl overdose. They died of fentanyl poisoning.
Okay.
They had no intention of taking fentanyl. They had no idea it was in there. So that's not an overdose.
Right. It wasn't intentional. They didn't realize they weren't taking fentanyl.
Right. It's homicide. It's not an accidental death. It's homicide.
Yeah. Your testimony before Congress was so moving, Rebecca. And I don't think anybody who was either on that room or watching it live didn't have a tear in their eye. I mean, it was incredibly emotional. I'm so grateful to you for sharing your story, as horrifically painful as that must have been. I want to not start with what happened with the incident, but rather I want to start with Caleb and Kyler. Tell us about them. How old were they? What were some of their hobbies? What were some of their aspirations? I want to know who your boys were before we start talking about the horrible drug that took their lives.
Yeah, they were athletic. Caleb was just super smart, really, really intelligent, just extraordinary. We adopted Caleb the day he was born. We found out that his 16-year-old birth mother had picked us. We brought him home the next day. He had over 80 words at 10 months old, clear as a bell. He could say octopus, clear as a bell, at 10 months old. When he was a year and a half old, 18 months old, it was September 11th, and we went to a rally a week later, and they were playing the Armed Forces medley and a whole bunch of patriotic songs. And here he was, 18 months old, belting them out as loud as he could. He knew all the words, you know, to these patriotic songs at 18 months. He was brilliant. And I homeschooled them until Caleb was in seventh grade. Kyler struggled academically. So Kyler, we got him when he was 12 months old. He was 20 months younger than Caleb, and his birth mother got involved in heroin and tested positive 4 times during her pregnancy, including a week before he was born, and they let her take him home from the hospital.
And was she the same birth mother?
Same birth mother, yeah. Kyler's biological father tried to drown him when he was 9 weeks old while high on heroin. And so he went into foster care, and facing trial on those child abuse and neglect charges, they finally consented to us adopting him so he could be raised with his brother. And so when we got Kyler when he was 12 months old, he was already kind of haywire, but he was really like extraordinary because he was a gross motor child. In foster care, he climbed out of his crib at 10 months old.
An escape artist at 10 months old.
You know, we knew that he, you know, had sensory integration dysfunction, you know, later diagnosed as ADHD. So I tried doing like everything holistic. And homeschooling, you know, in many respects was great because he could, you know, stand up and jump around and stand on his head and do what he needed to do, like to clear, you know, the fog, right? So to speak.
Get some of that energy out.
Yeah. And he taught himself to ride a bike 2 days after his brother, 3 years old, but he didn't know how to brake. So, that's what Kyler was like. He was fearless, which was kind of an issue. He, loved to skateboard and just did so many death-defying things. You know, he struggled in that respect with impulse control. So we knew that they were at-risk children. And so, you know, we gave them more warnings than any parent ever does. And, you know, told them of how important it is for them never to experiment.
Right. you and I were both lawyers, we're both law-abiding citizens and raising children who are also respectful of the law. But, you know, what would you say to, say another mom who says, listen, my kids follow the law, we follow the law, we're law-abiding citizens. Because if the attitude of that, like, this is what you get for buying, you know, illicit drugs, this is what you, it's a free country. And if people want to do this, we should, the law permits them to operate freely. How would you respond to that?
First of all, your kids are, you know, sort of the front lines. One of my son's friends, I ran into him a year after my boys died, and he told me, I didn't know the details of what he was doing with them, but he told me that he had been doing drugs with them. And he said, I want you to know that I got clean because of them. And he's like, I don't even do marijuana now. And he said that, I want you to know that your son's death started a movement here in this area. You know, there was, as I said, 17-year-old Sophia Harris died as well. And she attended the other high school in town. So their death started a movement. And he said it became, you'd be a pariah or you would be shamed if you brought any kind of drugs to a party. And that's what needs to happen. Even if your kids, aren't going to ever say yes, they need to be the people who stand up and say, and nobody else should either. And, call someone, call a parent, like you see something, say something, you know, tell the schools, whatever you see going on. Don't just stand by and do nothing and say nothing. Be part of the movement to shun this.
Right.
They wouldn't tell me what they were doing, but they were on Xanax. And I have a family member who takes Xanax for anxiety. People don't die from Xanax. I didn't think they were doing anything that could kill them. I knew that, they couldn't function like that. It's not healthy. Whatever they're doing wasn't good for them and getting them into trouble. But I didn't know what fentanyl was or Narcan or any of that stuff. I heard of the opioid crisis and, when Kyler had knee surgery from an injury in soccer, all five of my kids played soccer. And when he was in high school, I made sure that he did not get any opioids after because I knew the risk. I knew what's up in that respect. So when they got in trouble, they both repented and they went to jail. They were attempted breaking and entering. They were high and they tried to open a business door that was locked and then they left. That was it. But they got arrested because there was video footage. And, I was glad they were safe. I didn't know what was going on, but I was glad that they were safe and they got clean. And Caleb wanted to start sharing his story. We found their writings after the day after they died. Caleb wrote a long 2-page letter about, to tell students, why not to do drugs. And he really believed that he would, that he would conquer this. He was quoting scripture, I'm more than a conqueror. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. They were raised Christian. They knew scripture. They were right. Amazing.
These were boys that were looking forward to life. They were making plans for their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Kyler graduated the day before he died. And Kyler had said to me, I'm in here with all kinds of people who had horrible childhoods, raised in terrible neighborhoods, parents in jail or prison, and raised in a home full of drugs and alcohol. And he said to me, he starts crying. He says, you raised me right. Mm. He said, I have so many good memories. We did all kinds of fun things and went to cool places. And he said, I am so lucky you adopted me.
Yeah. The most evil things about these drugs, there's not one family that's safe from it. The most Christ-following home in the country with children who were homeschooled and had every possible opportunity that, their parents could afford them are just as much as risk as a child who's not being properly supervised.
There are certain things I would do over again. I never would have put them in public school. there was, you know, a drug problem at their school. They started getting the drugs from kids who were bringing it to school. Caleb told me in ninth grade from their parents' unlocked medicine cabinets. And then the vaping problems at the school. I wish I'd never put them in public school.
You live in a fairly, you know, middle class to affluent area in Michigan, do you not? I mean, so the public school there was not, we're not talking about an inner city, you know, school in New York or Chicago.
Right. A top five schools in the state of Michigan. And, you know, we're middle class, but yeah, they went to school with a lot of very affluent families. But there was a problem there. And, you know, there was another kid who died the same day as them in our hometown. And the superintendent's daughter died shortly before them. He doesn't talk about it because, you know, he doesn't want people to know, apparently. I don't know. The principal right. told me.
Yeah, and there's no shame in it because, again, as I just mentioned, you know, there's no one that's safe from it. And that's the, I think that's the most, you know, kind of gripping part of all of this, but also the part that's going to surprise most people because, as you said, you'd never even heard of fentanyl yourself until very recently. And I think you could probably put the average mom in there with you.
When Caleb was in jail, you know, here he is talking about, like, he was in jail. He was vice president of student council. He was in, he had been in AP classes. You know, he was a brilliant kid and a good heart. So, you know, Kyler said, like, you raised me right. And Caleb said, you know, you're my superhero. You always cared. You always went in our room. You know, you tried to do something. You tried to help.
Yeah. Well, let's focus a little bit then on, if you can, Rebecca, on that day that the boys were given these laced pills. Have the police or the detectives been able to sort of trace back what happened on that day? What were the circumstances surrounding it? And I know they were with another friend who also died.
Whenever I had heard the term laced, I always assume it's like, oh, marijuana laced with blah, blah, blah. You know, they weren't laced. There was no Percocet in it whatsoever.
Right.
You know, it was all fentanyl. And that's what they're doing with everything now. Even like heroin deaths. I don't know if you saw, but heroin deaths have plummeted. Because it's not heroin. It's all fentanyl. People think they're getting that or they think they're getting meth or they think they're getting whatever. It's almost all fentanyl now. And sometimes it's laced. Now they're mixing fentanyl with something called Trank. Its formal name is xylazine. Mm-hmm. And it's being mixed with fentanyl so that Narcan doesn't work.
Oh my gosh.
So you can't save them. And right. so that fentanyl detecting strips don't work. So, you know, there's no question that this is homicide, that they're out to kill our children.
Oh, I was just going to say there's absolute intentionality behind giving these pills. And so your boys thought that they were buying Percocet, but instead they were given straight fentanyl.
Right. And it was fake pills.
Okay. And then did someone see them like collapse? Were they in a public place or how were
they were
found?
At a hotel. My ex-husband, I'd asked him to take them to rehab. He actually heads up Celebrate Recovery at a church. So I thought he would be the one to have the resources to get them help. And instead, he took them to this hotel. And, you know, there was another girl who died with them, a 17-year-old girl. And there was another girl who survived, who woke up in the morning. She had never taken those pills and didn't call the police, didn't call for help. She called her friend, told a friend, like, oh my gosh, they're all dead, including her boyfriend. She thought was dead, but he was the drug dealer and he was saved with Narcan. Mm-hmm. So she just left them there the whole day until she saw the police outside because the 17-year-old girl, Sophia, her parents thought she was at a friend's house and realized like she had lied and she was missing and they were able to track her phone. So the guy who sold it to them was revived with Narcan and he had overdosed a month before and saved with Narcan. And his girlfriend who had been there, she had been overdosed a few months before with drugs he had given her and she was saved with Narcan. So like this drug dealer knew he was getting drugs with fentanyl. He knew.
And has he been sentenced? Has there been a criminal trial for him?
He got a plea deal. So he got 8 to 15 years for killing three people.
Well, you know, part of the congressional testimony where you gave, again, this incredibly raw and moving testimony about your your children and how this has affected your family. Let's just talk about the others who testified that day, including the sheriff from Arizona, who was most impressive, talking about just the vast quantities that are coming over the border and much of it going through a particular county in Arizona, from what I understand.
Yeah, and I have a friend, she works with a guy who owns a drone company, and he uses drones at the border to so they can rescue women who are being trafficked. Hmm. And so they see the drug traffickers and the sex traffickers and just flooding. And they have, you know, they're doing a documentary with their footage, so they haven't released it now, but they, you know, she tells me that they see just throngs of these people coming across the border.
The Biden administration is essentially welcoming these people into the border and then giving them protection instead of America's children and American adult citizens. What kind of response have you had to your testimony? And do you have any idea of what the impact of your personal story has made already? What was the sense you got from the lawmakers before whom you were testifying?
Well, first of all, I think that my testimony went viral because I went all mama bear because of the ranking House member, Benny Thompson, who spoke right before me. He had 5 minutes before my testimony. And I just started jotting notes while he was speaking about some of the things that he was saying. And this like rage just started building up inside of me because he was talking about xenophobia and racism and, you know, that we're a nation who welcomes people across our borders and, you know, think of why they're coming here. They're seeking protection. And so I started jotting those notes. I'm like, you're not protecting our children, you know?
Right.
And he also talked about how Trump, you know, separated children from their parents. And I'm thinking, they could be reunited through DNA. Like,
my children have been permanently separated. Yeah. Yeah, God gave you that statement because I think that was, you could see the way people, like their heads almost kind of snapped back when you said it, that they can be reunited with their children. I can never be reunited this side of heaven with my boys.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, if you watch the testimony, that's kind of like what I really lost it, is that when I said that my children were taken from me.
And the thing is, you're not a political operator in this particular area of public policy. I mean, you are a mom who lost her children. And I think sometimes, you know, we get caught up in, again, the cries of racism or not welcoming people. And, you know, but yeah, I thought it was really interesting that after your testimony, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a Republican congresswoman, she kind of suggested that your boys would be alive if the Biden administration had secured the border. Quite possibly they would still be with us. And then in President Biden's response, he claimed that those drugs had come over actually during President Trump's administration. And they kind of chuckled. And people were very taken aback by that. I know liberal Democrats who were taken aback by that response. What did you think when you heard that?
I started crying. I was like, is this for real? Are you serious? Like, you know, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I've had people like saying, oh, you should be angry with her. She did ask me point blank, you know, would they be alive today? And you'll see in my testimony that I made it clear when my boys died and that, you know, clearly, during the last administration.
I think there's a guilty conscience there because they know that the border isn't being properly secured. Kamala Harris, as our borders are, has done nothing.
I don't think they care. Honestly, this is the party of population control. Okay? Like, I've witnessed this for decades now. I don't think they care.
So in January of 2021, fentanyl, if you wanted to buy it directly rather than getting it, you know, unintentionally, as your boys did, it was, I think, about $100, you know, a hit. And now it's half that price. So there's just hordes of it coming across the border.
It's much, much less than that. It's $20.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what I read just the other day.
Okay. So then that's even an update from the figures that I have. In the first year of Biden's presidency, there was a 22% increase in the number of deaths from either fentanyl overdose or fentanyl poisoning. So we know that the border isn't being handled properly. We know that these drugs continue to come in. It seems like from the testimony of the sheriff, at least, that was with you, he's incredibly frustrated about the ways in which his hands are tied legally. Was there anything else that you gleaned about why this is being allowed to continue at this rate, given the number of everyday American families that this is impacting?
Again, the Democratic Party is the party who wants to decriminalize drugs. Like, look what they did in Oregon. Oregon's a mess. And they think that you can just decriminalize every drug and that it's going to make things better. Like, again, they don't care. This is, they're thinning out the herd. They really don't care. And it's absurd to think that somehow you can decriminalize fentanyl. You can't. And they try to make it sound like the Cato Institute guy who testified, try to make it sound like it's a supply or that it's a demand problem. That nobody's demanding, or very few people are actually demanding the fentanyl. It's the drug dealers that are demanding it. But the users, the end users, are not demanding fentanyl. This is a supply side problem. And honestly, when you look at the numbers that are coming across the border now. And they estimate, I went to a DEA family summit last Wednesday, and they said 5 to 10% gets intercepted. That's their guesstimate.
Right. So 90% of the drugs coming over are getting through.
Including like up here in Michigan. It was unbelievable. There was one traffic stop on a highway in Michigan that was just a random traffic stop that yielded enough fentanyl to kill a third of the Michigan population. And so there's these huge amounts coming across the border, enough to kill, this year they estimate enough to kill the world population 10 times over.
And again, you live in a very sort of nice part of Michigan, which is smack dab in the center of the country. Have you heard from your governor? And has she made any sort of statement about that massive bust that was found during the traffic stop that you just mentioned?
No, I've seen nothing on it. I heard from all kinds of leaders in Michigan when my sons died. I didn't hear anything from her. You know, she didn't call to wish me condolences. Like,
yeah. And even after your testimony, you testify nationally, and even still, she and her administration just ignore you.
No, I heard from a bunch of other leaders here in Michigan, our county sheriff, again, both times, but nothing from her. But I'm concerned about the numbers that are coming through, because, you know, why does there need to be enough fentanyl here to kill the world population, not the U.S. population, world population, right, 10 times over? I think there's more going on. The Pentagon has ordered auto injectors of Narcan in case of a terrorist attack. You have universities that have put out pieces on concern about what happens in the event of a terrorist attack using fentanyl. And medical organizations are discussing what to do in the event of a terrorist attack using fentanyl. There were some terrorists who kidnapped 130 people in Russia back in 2002. And the Russian government used fentanyl in an aerosol form and killed off all of the terrorists and all 130 hostages. And so, like, this technology to kill masses through fentanyl poisoning has been around since 2002. And everything I've read, if you Google this, you'll find a ton of academics discussing it, the government. They just made it so that Narcan will be available over the counter. Supposedly, it'll be on every street corner and in not just, you know, pharmacies, but in gas stations. Like, what do we need to know? Like, what's going on that they're not telling us?
Yeah, they're being far more aggressive about the antidote than they are about keeping the drug from getting into the hands of American people in the first place. And this is, the Democratic Party largely, they're always talking about addressing root causes, right? Root causes of crime, or root cause, but they're not very interested in attacking the root causes of the fentanyl crisis, which is an unsecure border and people not being properly screened who are coming into this country. So 300 young Americans are dying every single day in this country, every single day from fentanyl. What would you tell other parents of either teenagers or young adults about this drug? How can they help their own children if they know that their children are buying, you know, think they're buying, you know, whatever it is, painkillers or Xanax or what have you?
Or Tylenol and Advil. I've met parents whose kids got fake Tylenol and fake Advil. And I don't know if you saw in Pennsylvania where it was from a pot shop, like a tobacco shop, in two different cities that people dropped from fentanyl poisoning from THC gummy bears.
Yeah, like I said, you know, you're safe nowhere now. And if it's coming into legally operated medical establishments, everybody should be terrified. That's terrifying to think that people who were just thinking they're taking an Advil or a Tylenol wind up dead from fentanyl poisoning. But I mean, do you have, I mean, beyond drug education that most parents would be doing with their kids anyway, what suggestions would you make to them based on your own experiences with Caleb and Kyler?
I mean, there's no room for experimentation. You don't take anything from anybody, you know, unless you bought it from a store. Like Tylenol, even like don't take anything that somebody offers you. And I did a survey in our Lost Voices of Fentanyl group, and hundreds of people responded. Every single one of them said that marijuana was a gateway drug for their kids, that they started with marijuana. There's an article I just posted the other day from a physician who works with the Children's Hospital on the East Coast, who said every single case, the kids started with marijuana, and the average age that they started marijuana was 12, the average age. So you need to start educating your kids really young.
That is absolutely mind-boggling. And your story, again, I think I'm so glad God used it in the way that he did and made it go viral in the way that he did, because I think it provided a lot of parents with a bit of a wake-up call. What are the resources that you would send parents to? What are the good websites and organizations to look to get the kind of information that you've been telling me about today?
So I want to change the law. So resources have to be available, like every school. They have no resources. And even the sheriff's has no resources for this. So I'm working with my local sheriff but the DEA has all of that. They have a page on their website with everything you need to know.
At the Edify podcast here, we always like to leave people with practical wisdom to help them sort of live out their everyday lives, especially as people of faith. So what can and should be done by people listening to this today to help combat this issue of border control? What can the average citizen do?
Yeah, I mean, contact your legislators. We need to have the border secure. You know, you can't just say, oh, cartels are law-abiding, drug dealers, drug traffickers are law-abiding citizens, and they're all going to just line up like good little sheep at the border crossings. And we have a problem with law enforcement where there's not enough now. The DEA agent told me that they need 900, but people aren't applying. They need 900 agents, but law enforcement's at an all-time low. So you could try to throw money at it, but if you don't have the people to staff this, to fight, then what are we going to do? So I would, you know, ask people to consider going into law enforcement, honestly. I even started looking at jobs through the DEA. Like, I want to make a difference. Right. And there's a need for it.
And it's a vocation, like any other calling God gives us in our life. So I hope and pray, Rebecca, we know by faith that God makes all things work together for his good. And as horrific and painful as this was, I believe God's going to bring some good out of this. Both for yourself and for other families. And again, I thank you for sharing your very powerful story with us, for sharing it with the nation, and for allowing us to open those wounds again with you today to talk about your beautiful sons and your experience with them. And I know I can speak for the entire audience and all of the Edify staff when I say that you certainly will remain in our prayers.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To make it easier for you to listen to future Edify podcast episodes, please make sure you subscribe over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thank you.